This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Mass Strikes Expose ANC Betrayal of the South African People. Today on Taking Aim, we discuss the 1.3 million person public sector worker strike in South Africa. The workers are voting for the latest government concession to the demands of the workers. Before we go into the details and how this incredible strike and other strikes across South Africa are exposing what the ANC has done since its assumed power, let's go to Ralph Poynter and an update in the case of Lynn Stewart. Ralph.
Hi, Maya. How are you?
Fine. And you, and especially, how is Lynn?
Lynn is fine, and I can tell how she is when I enter the prison to visit. I notice the effect she has on the whole place, on the people there, the other inmates, her empathy, her understanding, her persona in there changes the place. So that tells me Lynn is doing well in spite of being in prison, and we all know about prison, her bad health, the conditions there. She is surviving it as best as can be expected.
And Ralph, you've filed the notice of appeal and are working on her appeal.
The notice was filed immediately with people saying stop and think about it, not knowing that we had thought about it for a long time, that she now faces an exposure of 30 years when she goes back to the appeal with the Second Circuit. And they said, take the 10 years and run. But we had discussed it before the sentencing. If it were more than 5 years, we would have another discussion. The 10 years puts it out of, you know, like nothing to discuss. 10 years, we're going to fight. And as Lynn says, you're not beaten until you quit, and she's never going to quit. This is an injustice. We're going to fight it through to the end.
And the 10 years is the resentencing that Judge Codal imposed on Lynn after the Second Circuit, in its appellate decision, had thrown the case back to him and said, hey, we want a much harsher sentence, up to 30 years.
Well, they did more than that. They said, either you increase the sentence or we're going to take the case back to ourselves and we'll make the sentencing, we'll make the law, we'll take it out of your hands. Exactly. Basically, one of the most arbitrary decrees that an appellate court has ever allowed itself without any grounding, any citable law, not one citable law whatsoever, just a hysterical rant on the part of judges who have a record of collusion with every nefarious force that's ever exerted itself in power in the United States. Corrupt judges, judges who are completely sold to the powers that be and beholden to what we call the terrorist in chief.
And it started in the very beginning. When Lynn was first indicted, it was noted that under the Clinton administration, they decided not to prosecute because there was no prosecution. And then Judge Codal himself said that it was very vague. The prosecution, so-called evidence, was very vague, and he threw it out. And then, under pressure, which is obvious, he took it back. So this was the first change. And then after the trial, we find out the government said, the prosecution from Washington said, any terrorist case has to have Osama bin Laden in it. And they put Osama bin Laden in the case. Although the judge said over and over again, he has nothing to do with the case. It's only admitted for the state of mind of the third defendant, which was a videotape in a garage that he was storing materials from the mosque. This was ridiculous, but the government influence on this case, the importance of the case as an exposure of fake terrorism. Terrorism, you know, started in Egypt by the Egyptian government, Imad Salem, the operative, who gets paid to come to America to entrap the sheikh, and the government involvement in this. And then they scream terror, terror. And Lynn Stewart's incarceration is based on her ability to speak so clearly and to expose the government and what they were doing. And when Lynn speaks, people listen. And when she was going around the country speaking at law schools and universities, talking about this case and the injustice of it, It was noted by the Second Circuit, and they stated in their papers, even after conviction, she continues to go around the country speaking out, corrupting our youth. This reminds me of Jesus, Muhammad, Socrates, all of those people who tell truth, and the people like yourself who are trying to tell the truth to get it out there today are in danger because truth becomes the enemy in a traitorous government that is led from the top.
Right on, Ralph.
Ralph, Lynn's address.
Lynn is at MCC, 150 Park Row, New York, New York. And remember to put her number 53504-054, and she will get her mail.
Ralph, everyone can go to Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart.org, or you can go to the Taking Aim website where we have a Lynn Stewart page.
Right, and you will see exactly where to send your letters to the Bureau of Prisons. The hope that we get Lynn in a situation in Danbury, Connecticut, close to New York, where the lawyers can visit her easily and where her friends, supporters, and family can get to her. And hopefully that she doesn't get the terrorist treatment where they shut her down. Because one of the things she had said to me, you could not imagine previous to this period where they could shut somebody down. But she has her 10 minutes a day that's included to call her lawyers, her friends, her family, her supporters, and that's it. And as you know, Ralph, we've been trying to get you in so you could do an updated,
right,
in-depth interview, and they say that you are a security risk.
Ralph. That's the same security risk that has Lynn in prison. Don't think, brothers and sisters, that we're not all on their target list, every one of us.
And I want to say a shout-out to the inmates there because Lynn brings an uplifting spirit. She's infected that whole tier with her love and understanding and concern.
Thank you, Ralph.
We'll be with you next week, Ralph.
I look forward to your program that is so needed on this history of South Africa. What happened to the ANC? What happened to the people of South Africa?
Thank you, Ralph. Thanks so much.
Mass strikes expose ANC betrayal of the South African people. Let's look at the conditions in South Africa today. One-third of the potential workforce is jobless. 1 million workers were laid off last year alone. The official unemployment rate of 25%, that's one-quarter of the population, doesn't address how many people are out of work. The real rate is 40%.
Actually, Maya, the rate of 40% only counts those who continue to look for work. There's a whole sector of the working class in South Africa that has no opportunity for work, that has abandoned even the prospect of work. The real number is closer to 60%, as Laban Mabasa and the Socialist Party of Azania have documented time and again.
Ralph, on Wednesday, August 18th, more than 1 million public workers, 1.3 million public sector workers, including most of the teachers and workers in the healthcare industry, also the police and the prison guards, went out on strike. It's now entering its third week. They gathered in protests outside the country's hospitals, the schools, the government buildings. As many as 90% of the unionized public workers joined the strike. Within 3 days, the government, the ANC government, acquired an injunction, a court injunction, to stop the strikes. But before that, the government sent the police and the army to enter the hospitals and assume the work that the health workers refused to do, and also attacked the picketers with stun grenades and actual bullets. There were many injured people. ANC government turning on its own members because this was a strike of COSATU, the union syndicate of the ANC. What were the workers demanding? They're demanding increased wages and housing allocations that had already been won by the private sector workers in the automobile industry, that had been on strike weeks before. They were demanding an 8.6% increase in the annual wage negotiations. This would put them ahead of inflation. They are already extremely low-wage workers, and they would like to improve their conditions so that they can have a home, they can send their children to school, and have health care themselves. This 8.6% increase is a meager increase. The Kasatu workers were looking for a 1,000 rand housing allotment. This is to help subsidize their housing costs. That's $137.
Take-home pay of these workers is not enough for them to survive, and that's true across the board in South Africa. And as we will be discussing, brothers and sisters, the enormous concentration of wealth in the hands of this tiny apartheid apparatus that remains intact, not only the capitalist class, but a layer of functionaries of the ANC itself that are now a privileged sector, a kind of black veneer to the old intact apartheid white structure of power, which we will be documenting in particular. This is a class betrayal, a fundamental betrayal, because the struggle in South Africa was for the empowerment of the masses, not for the enshrinement of apartheid control and capitalist rule and the immiseration of the population on a scale never before experienced, even under apartheid, as we will document.
Ralph, Kasatu, which is the coalition of 21 separate trade unions, represents 1.8 million workers. And of these 1.8, we have 1.3 million on strike. Today, the breaking news is that the government of Zuma, despite its claims that it would not move from its 7% offer, has gone back to the table, and President Jacob Zuma's ministers are now offering a 7.5% increase in wages and $109 a month for the housing allowance. That's 800 rand. There's going to be a vote, but the leaders of SADTU, which is the teachers' union, and that has 250,000 members, most of whom are on strike, have said that they would find it difficult to push their members to vote for this agreement. And the reason is that teachers in South Africa at the moment are making only $15,000 a year. As they have said, quote, we demand a living wage. And that is not what they're going to have from this offer by the government. They have a long way to go. Kasatu has come out and said that the ministers have, quote, a caviar lifestyle while expecting the workers to scrimp. And there's the symbolism because the ANC ministers, just like the apartheid government ministers, drive around in BMWs and Mercedes-Benz at public expense and pay themselves wages, salaries, that are more than 20 times the salary of the highest paid public sector workers. The caviar lifestyle is a primary grievance of the workers of South Africa.
Well, it has to be emphasized, brothers and sisters, that the public sector workers are backed by the miners, by private industry, and that the 2 million more workers are scheduled to come out on strike on Thursday. So this is not just the public sector workers, which is a significant portion of the most advanced sectors of the working class. This is the private sector. This is the heart of mining industry. This is the heart of industrial action in South Africa. This is the working class in motion, notwithstanding the restraints that have been imposed upon them by COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, whose General Secretary Zewenzima Wavi has made rhetorical feints at President Zuma, but who has said he has blood like we have blood, he has a big family like we do, he has children to feed like we do, our needs are the same, constantly signaling to the government that the COSATU leadership will give verbal support to the militant workers, but little more than that.
Ralph, there is a building class struggle in South Africa. In 2007, there were mass strikes, and those were the largest in the history of South Africa. the workers will not stand still. There have been strikes throughout the year. In June, workers at the state-owned electricity generator Eskom, which is the fourth largest electricity generator in the world, won a 9% wage increase and a 1,500 rand housing allowance. So the public sector workers are looking at these other public sector workers and say, why them and not us? The electricity generation workers at Eskom won this concession, this increase in their wages and housing allowance, after they threatened to turn the lights out during the World Cup. The World Cup, which was paraded before the world as the symbol of unity in South Africa. What people don't realize is that actually during the World Cup, the security guards were on strike and the South African government called in the police to provide security for the World Cup stadiums. Transnet workers who run the state-owned freight train network, the pipelines and the ports, also won a 9% raise in their wages in May after they struck for 18 days, halting all exports. And the auto workers just won a 10% pay raise this year, with 9% next year, an extension of pension rights to all contract workers. Now, the automotive industry is the largest manufacturing export sector and accounts for 6% of the South Africa's gross domestic product. BMW, which manufactures cars in South Africa, lost production of 2,000 vehicles during this automotive industry strike. All major car companies were having difficulty reaching their export targets this year because of that closure. So we had key industries on strike already this year, and they won much larger demands than that demanded by COSATU for the public sector workers. There was precedent for COSATU to demand an 8% increase for the hospital workers, for the teachers, for the prison guards, and for the police. They were demanding 8.6, when in fact the government had already conceded and given 9% to the electricity workers, similarly to the Transnet, that's the freight workers, and that in the private industry, the auto workers had won 10% for this year and another 9% for next year. Why the exceptionalism for the public sector workers? Ralph.
Well, Maya, one has to keep in mind that in 2007, the public sector workers went out and stayed out a month, and they were demanding a 12% increase, and in fact, COSATU called an end to that strike action with a 7.5% wage increase, and the workers did not forgive the COSATU leadership for calling off that strike. And indeed, what we have to keep in mind, it is not only the private sector, the mining industry, and the auto industry in the heart of the industrial working class that is ready to join this strike, but you were mentioning the police. Well, the police union and the soldiers union have both declared their readiness to join the strike. To get a measure of the radicalization that is unfolding within the working class is the fact that the police union and the soldiers union has declared themselves ready to join the workers and are refusing to obey orders. Consequently, the attempt on the part of the government to use water cannon and bullets and grenades, which they've used with certain special forces, is being rejected by the police and by the soldiers generally. This is a class crisis for the rulers of South Africa.
That's right, Ralph. The soldiers call themselves workers in uniform, and they resent being used as scabs against their brothers and sisters. Let's look at some of what has happened in South Africa with the ANC government. 70% of the population live under the poverty line, and these are statistics presented in Marxist.com in an article, a very important article called South African Public Sector Workers Launch All-Out Strike, written by Jorge Martin on August 19th. This is a day after the strike. And he notes, 70% of the population live under the poverty line. 1 million workers, as I mentioned before, lost their jobs in 2009 when the economy contracted by 1.8%. The housing shortage is a chronic problem, and as we discussed, the workers in South Africa get a housing allotment, that's a subsidy, in addition to their wages. The official government figures estimate 2.1 million units are needed to house 12 million people who have no decent housing and live in what they call informal settlements, meaning squatter camps. This is 24% of the population. That's a huge number. Almost one in four people in South Africa need housing. And the public sector workers, many of them don't earn enough to buy a house, and they earn too much to qualify for the subsidized, that's the RDP, housing programs. Ralph.
Well, Maya, the ministers earn 143,000 rands a month. The public sector workers have 7,000.
While the teachers, the average teacher is 14,000, many of the other public sector workers, such as in the hospitals and the clerks, are earning half that amount. And it's barely enough for the teachers to survive, so you can imagine how it is for the other public sector workers.
And actually, on the first day of the strike, the government used special police forces against the striking workers, and at the Soweto Hospital, they fired bullets and used water cannons against the pickets. The SADTU, the South African Democratic Teachers Union, denounced the use of bullets against striking teachers in KwaZulu-Natal. The trade unions began to block major highways in Gauteng. Living up to the revolutionary tradition of the South African workers in the Greater Durban area, they began organizing flying pickets, calling themselves the Bafana Bafana, the nickname of the national football team during the World Cup. The workers moved from place to place, shutting down one government building and hospital after the other. We have shut down St. Aidan's, R.K. Khan, Nkosi, Albert Lutuli, Addington, and King Edward Hospital, said Bafana Bafana spokesperson Siyule Ninchoko, who is chairman of the King Edward branch of the National Education, Health, and Allied Workers Union, as reported by SAPA News Agency. 31,000 members of the National Union of Metal Workers, NUMSA, have joined the strike, an all-out strike since August. They are demanding a 15% wage increase. The union is demanding the banning of the use of labor brokers in this highly unionized industry. NUMSA has now threatened to spread strike action to manufacturers, retail sellers, and garages. There's a massive buildup of anger on the part of the workers, and the beginning of the strike has shown a willingness to struggle. The government is under pressure from big business to withstand the pressure of organized labor, and the leaders of COSATU are coming under huge pressure from bourgeois opinion to make concessions, and in a real sense, they're pushing on an open door, because the strike of the public sector workers reveals the contradictions of the so-called tripartite alliance between the ANC, COSATU, and the Communist Party. While Zuma's ANC government has taken an intransigent position towards the demands of the workers, the Communist Party and COSATU members sitting in parliament, including ministers, are bluntly challenged by rank and file. Whose interests are you serving? The interests of the workers or the interests of the capitalists?
In the second part of our show, we're going to go into detail on that tripartite agreement and what it has meant for the people of South Africa. I want to go into some of the acts of the government. But before I even do that, look at that NUMSA strike. That's a very important strike that's continuing in the auto industry, because you mentioned their demand to put an end to labor brokers. Labor brokers mean part-time temporary workers without a union contract. It's very important, as in the U.S., to have a union long-term contract with your benefits and your wages set, rather than being a temporary worker. Let's look again at this government injunction that happened August 21st, 3 days after the workers went on strike, when the government got the courts to say that they were forcing workers in, quote, emergency services, such as the hospitals, to go back to work. But the workers, the unions, refused to accept or abide by it. The government then said it was going to institute these special courts, such as it did during the World Cup, to deal with, quote, acts of hooliganism. That's what they were calling workers. They were calling them hooligans. Being on strike was an act of hooliganism. And they started arresting the strikers. Their excuse was to, quote, prevent violence against non-strikers. But in fact, there wasn't violence against non-strikers. The violence was the government using portions of the army and the police against the strikers. And dozens of strikers were arrested immediately, and six members of the teachers' union were injured in South Johannesburg when the Metro Police opened fire without warning against a peaceful march. And three SATU members were shot with rubber bullets while picketing in a city in the Northwest Province.
Well, Maya, these actions put enormous pressure on COSATU General Secretary Vavi, who called on members of the police union pop crew, quote, not to allow the employers to use them to crush the strike, unquote. It's extraordinary to read the response of pop crew to this call. Pop crew spokesperson Norman Mampani read the following statement. Hereby today, we wish to state categorically our intention to join the National Public Service strike action as a revolutionary duty to ensure that our working class power and a demand for a living wage are asserted. Not only the police union announced its intention to join the strikers, the soldiers union stated, we will not be used as scabs. Jeff Dobazana, speaking for the South African National Defense Union, stated, the problem is not solved. We will not be seen as scab labor. We're not going to allow our workers to be seen in that fashion. We are planning action. The other soldiers' union, SASFU, took the same position in an official statement. We are soldiers advancing working class power. The statement which describes the union members, we are workers in uniform, said the security first forces will not allow themselves to be used in a manner that undermines the rights of workers to strike. The continual use of soldiers as scab labor in hospital is not only unsustainable, it is parasitic. The very soldiers stand to benefit from this settlement, and we support the demand of our brothers and sisters, the public service workers. This government should be careful of developing a negative relationship between the soldiers and the poor, because this will strain any future cooperation. The statement ends with a call on all SASFU members to engage in actions of solidarity with the men and women that continue to live in uncertainty while the wealthy and the privileged and the functionaries reap all the benefits. These are statements, brothers and sisters, that have not been heard from soldiers and police since the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yes, Ralph, they are incredibly important statements. Because how can the government enforce its injunction? How can it have the police and the army run the hospitals if the police and army show their solidarity with the workers, with the people of South Africa, their brothers and sisters? This is an incredible alignment and would bring down the government. You have to remember that it is the movement of labor that brought President Zumba into government and the downfall of the Mbeki government. Let's look at what Zuma has been doing to try to drive a wedge with the world against the South African workers. Aside from the injunction, aside from bringing scabs into the hospitals, aside from the attacks on the peaceful demonstrators and the pickets, there has been a public relations campaign throughout the world to the discredit of The Guardian and to the discredit of The New York Times. They have been putting forward the South African government propaganda against the workers. August 27th, New York Times, an article by Celia Duggar, and the title is Labor Unrest Empties South African Hospitals. It starts, most patients in the hulking seven-story tuberculosis hospital here, all infected with potentially lethal drug-resistant strains of the disease, have gone home since a majority of nurses, orderlies, and janitors went on strike a week and a half ago. The hospitals are paralyzed, and so are the schools across South Africa. Quote, undercutting major drives to combat AIDS and TB and to repair a deeply troubled education system. What is not said in this attack on the workers is what the working conditions are for these workers. And what's not said in this article is that the poverty that produces this drug-resistant strain of disease, that produces the 70% poverty in South Africa, is the role of imperialism and the collaboration of this ANC government with imperialism that has created these poverty conditions and that has pushed the workers to leave the hospitals, because how else can they get their demands met, demands for a living wage? Ralph, we need to pause for station identification. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Mass Strikes Expose ANC Betrayal of the South African People. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I want to mention that the question about the role of Jacob Zuma, the current president who succeeded Mbeki, largely because the corruption of the Mbeki regime and its complete subordination to the old apartheid apparatus led to a near revolt, and Jacob Zuma, no different in any respect from Mbeki, was the beneficiary through a certain amount of demagogic alignment with the protesters. But here we have the real vision of who is Jacob Zuma when he is called to account for himself by none other than Princeton Lyman of the Council on Foreign Relations. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, a conversation with Jacob Zuma. I am Princeton Lyman, adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations on African Studies. We also have via teleconference council members participating around the country and indeed around the world. Today is the Darrell Behrman Lecture, endowed by the Behrman family in the memory of Darrell Behrman, who came from South Africa, a very successful businessman in the United States, and as he was in South Africa, very concerned with international peace and the future of South Africa. These are momentous times in South Africa, the most momentous since the end of apartheid in 1994. There are major changes underway in the leadership of the African National Congress. We had the resignation of President Thabo Mbeki just 7 months short of the end of his second term. We have a movement underway by some people to break away from the ANC. So let's have a look at what are the ways in which the Council on Foreign Relations indicates clearly to Jacob Zuma that they are taking his temperature and that he had damn well better perform. Over and again, they question him about what is the intention of Zuma and the ANC with respect to the respect of private property and the respect of the relationship with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. We have the land issue, says Zuma, a serious matter in South Africa, but we want to handle it responsibly. An indication of a democratic society is that there are no issues that are taboo. So it's not the question of one day we wake up and we say we must change the economy. No. We believe that America has come out very strongly to take advantage of the open economy that we have, and we will deepen that relationship. We feel it to be very important for South Africa, as well as for the continent of Africa. Lyman, Princeton. Zimbabwe, Zuma. Zimbabwe laughs. I would have been surprised if that question that did not arise. South Africa will adopt the correct stand on Zimbabwe. We know you will agree that we are correct. He is again challenged. I am Lawrence Freeman from Executive Intelligence Review. Mr. Zuma, one of the difficulties facing Mr. Mbeki has been the failure of the economy to provide for some poorer people in the society. If you're the president, how are you going to be able to deal with the 40% that are suffering from poor economic conditions? Okay, we have free trade, we have energy. Zuma chuckles. Well, yes, the issue of free trade. We are in favor of increasing the interaction between South Africa and the United States. The issue is that we should negotiate as a bloc with the United States, and we will do that, and you will be satisfied. Your financial crisis is going to make an impact, because that's what it's going to do. It's going to slow down economic growth, and it's going to have an impact to the poor. The challenge to us is to find a way to meet your needs as well as ours. The policy provisions that we are taking have that in mind. That's why we have talked very much about the need for quality job creation and with economic policies that are acceptable on the global scale. After the discussion continues, we have in South Africa a situation of what we are calling the two economies, the first economy and the second economy. And there is some discussion about how to close the gap. It's a tough issue. The first economy is regulated. The regulation of the first economy does not take into consideration the second economy. So we are going to develop an economy in the first that does not suffocate the second. We open up a situation in which we will need your help, and we expect to receive it. Lyman Princeton. Thank you very much for being with us today, Mr. Zuma, and for your reassurances. It has been a wonderful conversation. Zuma, thank you very much. It is a wonderful conversation. Or as they used to say in the 1930s, yassa.
Ralph, let's look at what the ANC did when it became the government in power. It was a move from racial to class apartheid. And this was the title of a monthly review article, March 2004, From Racial to Class Apartheid, South Africa's Frustrating Decade of Freedom, which is an understatement, by Patrick Bond. What they point out in this article, which misterms it the neoliberal policies of the ANC, rather than talking about its class collaboration, the starts off by saying that the government, the ANC majority, with Nelson Mandela as the new president, did not alter the enormous structural gap in wealth between the majority black and minority populations. In fact, the income disparity in South Africa has widened since the ANC took over. And let's look at how this happened. One, the ANC allowed the white population to keep the best land instead of returning the land to the people. It allowed them to control the mines, the manufacturing plants, and the financial institutions. The ANC instituted a policy where the state-owned industries, such as electricity and transport, had to recoup their costs. They would not be subsidized. Consequently, one of the first things the ANC did was to raise the electricity and water rates, which meant that many people throughout the country could not pay their water or electricity bills. This was the policy of 100% cost recovery. The electricity and water consumed 30% of the income of the household earning less than $70 a month. An estimated 10 million people had their water cut off, and 10 million people were also the victims of electricity disconnections. Another first step of the ANC was to assume the apartheid debt of $25 billion. Ralph.
Patrick Bond writes, on December 1, 1993, it was the point at which the struggle for socioeconomic justice in South Africa was conclusively lost. The very first act of that government was to accept an $850 million loan from the International Monetary Fund, ostensibly for drought relief. The loan's secret conditions were leaked to the main business newspaper in March 1994, and they were classical structural adjustment. Lower import tariffs, cuts in state spending, huge cuts in public sector wages, and in addition, Michael Cam de Suys, IMF managing director, put intense pressure on President Mandela to reappoint the two main stalwarts of the apartheid-era economic policy, the finance minister and the central bank governor, both from the National Party of Verwoerd. The two people put in charge of the economy of the government of Mandela were the finance minister and the central bank governor of the apartheid regime. Another crucial milestone was reached in 1996 when the top echelon of ANC policymakers imposed a, quote, non-negotiable, wide-ranging economic strategy without consulting its alliance partners in the union movement, the South African Communist Party, much less its constituents. The World Bank contributed economists and a model for the exercise known as Growth, Employment, and Redistribution, or GEAR, introduced to promote investor confidence in the wake of a currency crash. GEAR allowed the government to distance itself from a reconstruction and development program, which in 1994 had served as the ANC's campaign platform, a basically Keynesian capitalist program, but nominally reformist. The promises generated by the World Bank's econometric model were grand. By 2000, the South African economy, they said, would be growing at 6%. In fact, a recent document that there is a 10-year review available on the government's website reveals that none of this was true.
Ralph, the income disparity increased. Black income particularly has fallen, and absolute poverty levels have increased, 70% of the population living below poverty line. The average black African household income in South Africa fell 19% between 1995 and 2000, while the white household income rose 15% to $22,600. But it's not just relative, but the absolute poverty intensified as the proportion of households earning less than $90 of real income increased from 20% of the population to 28% in 2000. And as I mentioned before, 70% of the population is living in poverty. The richest 20% earn 65% of all income. We talked about the cutoff of water and electricity, but also evictions. 2 million people were evicted from their homes or land since liberation in 1994. 13 million were given access to fixed telephone line for the first time, but 10 million were disconnected because they couldn't pay the bill. This is the reality of South Africa. We should also note that the ANC government, one of its first moves, aside from assuming the debt, aside from retaining the apartheid ministers in key financial positions, that they cut the primary corporate taxes dramatically from 48% in 1994 to 30% in 1999, thus giving a real tax holiday to the white-owned industry and presenting the public sector with decreased funding. And not only that, they allowed the major corporations to move their home bases to London and to take their stock listings off the South African Stock Exchange and move those to the London Bourse. This meant that the capital flow went out of South Africa. Ralph.
Yes, Maya, the Monthly Review article is extremely precise. There were three currency crashes engineered by the IMF and the World Bank, witnessed over a period of weeks in February and March 1996, June and July 1998, and December 2001, ranging up to 50%, leading to massive interest rate increases that sapped growth and rewarded the major speculators. These moments of macroeconomic instability were as dramatic as any other incident during the previous two centuries, including the September 1985 financial panic that split business from the apartheid regime. Domestic investment is less than 2%. In fact, the reality, as the article states, is that South Africa has witnessed the replacement of racial apartheid with class apartheid, systemic underdevelopment, segregation of the oppressed majority through structured economic, political, legal, and cultural policies. Pretoria's neoliberal orientation has never been in doubt. Current President Thabo Mbeki succeeded Mandela in 1999.
When they say current president, because the article was written.
It was written, as you say, before the fall of Mbeki. But the job loss has been, as they said, the most damaging aspect. Instead of employment growth of 3% promised by GEAR, unemployment rose from 16% to 30%. Frustrated job seekers bring that figure of unemployed to 43%. As I mentioned earlier, brothers and sisters, those are official numbers. The unofficial numbers are far higher, as much as 60%. White businesses wanting to escape the economic stagnation, declining profits, born of a classic overaccumulation crisis, began to remove their capital. and here are the core concessions made by the ANC. While whites and corporations removed their capital from the country, although continuing to reside in South Africa, they enjoyed even greater privileges than they did under apartheid.
Ralph, as I mentioned, one of the first moves was the decrease in the corporate taxes.
Yes. Notwithstanding the deeper poverty, the ANC raised water and electricity prices so dramatically that they consumed 30% of the income of those households earning less than $70 per month. And indeed, Maya, as you had mentioned, this is the beginning of the end of any hope of economic advancement in South Africa.
How did they buy off the ANC officials who had come into power? They bought them off with the Black Economic Empowerment Program, the BEE, as this empowerment program immediately gave to Cyril Ramaphosa, one of the leaders of the ANC, originally when he set up his Black Empowerment Enterprise, his New Africa Investment Company, he had 20%, Nathatu Motlana, another 20%, John T. Sandler, 20%, Dick Gang Mosenke, 20%, and Zwelinkwe Sisulu, 20%. This was an incredible corporate structure, and Moletsi Mbeki, the brother of the former president, wrote a book called Architects of Poverty, in which he calls for the dumping of the BEE, which he interpreted as a master plan by white businesses to entrench its longevity within the mainstream economy. And this is a significant quote from the brother of the former president, who was the bulwark of the class collaboration of the ANC. Quote, BEE was in fact invented by South Africa's economic oligarchs, that handful of white businessmen and their families who control the commanding heights of the country's economy, that is mining and its associated chemical and engineering industries and finances. The object of BEE was to co-opt leaders of the Black resistance movement by literally buying them off with what looked like a transfer to them of massive assets at no cost. To the oligarchs, of course, these assets were small change. And that is from Mbeki's new book, Architects of Poverty. In its formative years, it was the investment bankers who smiled all the way to the bank after employing sophisticated financial engineering structures that left these empowerment beneficiaries in heavy debt when the markets imploded. In particular, the special purpose vehicle financing structure did not fare well, just as we saw in the United States. So the country itself was left with a assumed, they could have said they weren't going to repay it. After all, the apartheid government of Botha refused to repay the debt after there were all the sanctions imposed on the apartheid government. But the ANC government agreed with the IMF and the World Bank that it would assume a $25 billion crippling debt and repay it. Ralph.
Maya, to give you a measure of what has been done to the population, 2 million people have been evicted from their homes or land since 1994, with public health care services in total disarray due to underfunding and the increased penetration of private providers. Infectious diseases such as tuberculosis, cholera, malaria, and AIDS are rife, far more prevalent than during apartheid. Diarrhea kills 43,000 children a year as a result of inadequate potable water provision. Most South Africans with HIV have no prospect of receiving antiretroviral medicines. And in fact, a rollout of medicines promised by the cabinet immediately was defaulted upon. Mbeki repulsed local opposition from human rights and arms control groups to the $6 billion purchased of sophisticated weaponry from European corporations. Moving to the environment, South African ecology is in the worst condition. Water and soil resources absolutely contaminated. South Africa's contribution to global warming, fisheries, and industrial toxics genetic modification far exceeds that during apartheid. Africa's biggest dam supplies water to Johannesburg, and further dams have been decimated and destroyed. Residual apartheid ecology could be cited, as the article declares, deleterious impacts of industrialization on biodiversity. it is important to add that the government's canard of insufficient state capacity to solve social and environmental problems has been matched by a willingness to turn all resources over to the private sector, outsourcing, corporatization, and privatization on a scale that has never before been undertaken. Huge, large, wealthy markets are now in control. To consider the mess created in the lucrative telecommunications center in which 30% of state-owned telecom was sold to a Houston firm, the cost of local costs skyrocketed, 20,000 workers were fired, attempts by the government to cap fixed-line monopoly pricing were blocked by the Texas-Malaysia joint venture with a court challenge, and the field of transportation, commercialized toll roads are unaffordable to the poor. Air transport privatization led to the collapse of the first regional state-owned airline, South African Airways. The privatization of the airports company led to security lapses. Constant strife has thrown the port privatization into disarray. The corporatized rail services shut down feeder routes. Electricity sectors were privatizing rapidly, with 30%, the world's fourth largest electricity producer, sold, resulting in multiple problems. 30,000 electricity workers lost their jobs. On and on and on. For the 10% of the wealthiest whites and a scattering of rich blacks who enjoy segregation and insulation from the vast majority, their lifestyles remain at the highest level in the world, while the population in South Africa is in free fall. Across South Africa, 100% cost recovery led to the continent's worst ever cholera outbreak, catalyzed by mass disconnection of rural residents from sanitation and from prepaid water. How did the degeneration of this once proud liberation movement occur so decisively? Asks Monthly Review. What about housing? The housing has disappeared for the population. What black residents call kennels, hundreds of thousands of post-apartheid starter houses are half as large as the 40-square-meter matchboxes built during apartheid, located even further away from jobs and community amenities.
Ralph, next week we'll discuss in greater detail which way forward for the South African economy and the people of South Africa. But I want to point out how Leon Trotsky insisted that the democratic tasks that confront oppressed countries like South Africa can only be resolved in the course of a socialist revolution and the establishment of a worker state, what's called permanent revolution. And this was understood by Steve Biko, the liberation fighter who was assassinated, when he said, quote, "If the economic basis, the capitalist rule in South Africa under the apartheid regime, is not transformed to a different framework, a socialist framework, there will be no way in which people can address the inequalities that were central effectively." Ralph?
The core question here is that the politics of two stages in the South African or in other revolutions, a capitalist stage and a later stage, are a policy of collusion and collaboration with neocolonialism and submission to the world capitalist ruling class and to the markets and to the dictates of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. It means permanent pauperization. It means the immiseration of the population and the submission of the population to the most relentless dictates of capital. That is the fate of the population in South Africa. We will detail in shocking particularity the magnitude of the betrayal of the workers and of the population of South Africa in our program next week.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Mass Strikes Expose ANC Betrayal of the South African People, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We'll be with you next week.